Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Color Podcast for the 12th day of September 2019. It is a Thursday. That puts us one day closer to Friday. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for tuning in, telling a friend, spreading the word, sharing on social media, all that good stuff. We only grow because of you, and it's because of you that we grow, which doesn't make any sense. But hey, I'm winging it. Thanks for all that you do, seriously. And email me if you want to enter to win the Sean Parnell signed book. Email is Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. You have until 10 p.m. tonight, Thursday, the 12th of September. Sometimes people listen late, like a couple days behind. Some people are a week behind, and they enter to win books that are already given away. And it's a current event show. There's a new one every day. You got to keep up with it. Keep up with it, people. Now I can announce who's on the show tomorrow, though, because it actually happened. I didn't jinx it. We have Michelle Malkin in studio. Spent a good half an hour plus with Michelle talking about her new book, which we will have a signed copy to give away, and a signed copy of one of her older books to give away as well. But don't enter now. If you enter before Friday afternoon or Friday, I guess, when the show goes up, you will be ignored just because it gets too cluttered. I'm trying to run this whole show alone, and it gets to be a pain. And I get confused and enter people into the wrong drawing. So just wait until the official announcement on Friday's show. Then email your heart's content away and try to win that. Right now it's about Sean Parnell and All Out War. So there you go. All right, let's get into it. We do have a lot of things to talk about. Tonight is another Democratic debate. This one, a smaller one, and only one night of debates. They're trying to winnow the field. We have the New York Times being the New York Times when it comes to 9/11. You would think that of all the things that the New York Times could get right, it would be September 11th. But they couldn't. They couldn't. We have a whole bunch of other stuff, too. Time permitting, of course. But first, I want to tell you about our lovely, great sponsor, Life Change Tea. It's a game changer. Since I've been drinking Life Change Tea, I've noticed I'm feeling so much better, and I can't tell you how much more energy I have. And I've gotten emails from some of you who attest to the same thing. You're regular. You're feeling better. It's great. How does it work? Life Change Tea is a proprietary herbal formula. It's a gentle daily cleanse designed to rid your body of all the waste that's sitting around inside of you. Look, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, food was different. It was better. It wasn't as processed and full of pesticides and God knows what else. It was nourishing and healthy for your body. Today, not so much. Pesticides, herbicides, heavy, heavy processing, they've depleted the nutrition in our food. It's no wonder you feel run down. Well, that's where Life Change Tea comes in. It gets rid of everything that's blocking your body from absorbing all the nutrients that are in our food. It cleans you out. Use as directed. Follow the instructions. Trust me on that. Try it for yourself. Go to getthetea.com now. That's getthetea.com. Get ready for more energy. I drink it every day. I've got a half a gallon sitting in the fridge. You brew up a bunch of it. Don't drink it like normal tea. It's not normal tea, although it tastes like it. Life Change Tea is not available in stores. Go to getthetea.com now. Enter promo code Derek at checkout, and you get free shipping. You can't beat the deal. Life Change Tea, getthetea.com. Okay, let's talk about the New York Times. What a horrible... I mean, you know that leftists want to downplay 9/11. They've never really been comfortable with 9/11. They had the internal debates about what we did to deserve it pretty soon after. And it wasn't just the bigwigs. It wasn't the networks. It was all the way down to the street level. I actually had a friend named Gloria in Baltimore who I would hang out with. She was one of the few people I knew when I moved to Baltimore. She was a friend of my friend, lived in his building. And after 9/11, we were G-chatting probably 2 or 3 days. Not G-chatting. G-chatting wasn't in existence. We were AOL Instant Messaging. For you kids out there, ask your parents what AOL Instant Messenger was. It was groundbreaking when it first came out. And we're having this instant messenger chat, and she's a big lib, and she starts talking about basically how we deserved this. We had it coming. And I was pissed off. I was pissed off you know, obviously after the attacks. And I was really pissed off hearing this. I never spoke to her again. I never had any communication. I don't know what ever became of her. We theoretically lived three blocks away from each other and would hang out occasionally on a Friday or a Saturday, go out. But after that, I was just done. That mentality is insane. And it's the same sort of mentality that causes people to look at CNN did a report yesterday, of all days, yesterday, about how the real threat to America is right-wing terrorism. Right-wing terrorism is killing more people, blah, 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 blah. They never really fully define what constitutes right-wing terrorism because, well, they can't. And if you really get into it, it is, you see that it's garbage. But they like this talking point that the real problem isn't people who are willing to strap bombs to themselves or others and blow themselves up in shopping malls and outdoor markets. No, no, no. It is white Christians in this country. Now, every group has some bad apples, but I don't remember the last time a white Christian walked into a shopping mall with some plastic explosives and a bunch of ball bearings strapped to them and blew themselves up or blew up others. I don't remember that. Maybe I missed it. I only follow the news for a living, so anything's possible. But it's that mentality that you cannot talk about. Well, they love the phrase marginalized people. Well, the people, they're marginalized, and therefore pretty much anything they do is okay and deserving. The United States deserves it. It's a horrible country. So if you want to attack the United States, you're going to have a good 40% of this population on your side, the Democratic Party, for the most part. What did the New York Times tweet? The New York Times sent out a tweet linked to a story or to commemorate September 11th. They wrote, quote, 18 years have passed since airplanes took aim and brought down the World Trade Center. Today, families will once again gather and grieve at the site where more than 2,000 people died. There are a couple things wrong with that tweet, which they ultimately deleted because they were catching so much hell over it. The airplanes were not autonomous beings. You have to kind of expect that they would blame the airplanes. They blame the gun, not the shooter, not the gunman, not the monster who shoots people, but it's the gun, the inanimate object itself. And the planes, unless they've become self-aware, and it has been, you know, more than a year since I've flown, so I'm not up on the latest, you know, airline technology, but I don't think they've become autonomous just yet. The planes took aim. Since airplanes took aim and brought down the World Trade Center, those airplanes were steered by somebody. Those airplanes were steered by radical Islamic terrorists, 19 of them, as a matter of fact. Yet the New York Times, you would never know that. Now, luckily, most people know that. Yet I don't think we're realizing the sort of seismic shift that we're coming up to. It was 18 years ago. That means anybody born on September 11th, 2001, and the days after in 2001, they'll be able to vote next year. They will have no memory of 9/11, no firsthand knowledge of 9/11. They won't remember that anger in the pit of their stomach, the pissed off feeling that you had, the desire for vengeance, the desire to get those sons of bitches and every one of them and make them pay for what they did on that day. They'll have no memory of it. It's a bit like right now, millennials really have no memory of the Cold War, and they're not being taught about it in schools. So then you end up in a situation where if you poll millennials, considering the bastardization of the education system, they say, you know what, socialism's pretty good. Socialism sounds great. And if you describe it right, leaving out the bad bits like 100 million dead and absolute power, not allowed to speak out against the government, you basically a ward of the state your whole life, you can make socialism sound pretty damn good. if you, especially if you have no real world experience. What, everybody just gets stuff? Everything is free. Everybody just goes to work for the sheer satisfaction of doing something, and nobody really gets ahead, and everybody shares in it all, and oh, God, it just sounds like utopia. It never is. It never comes close to utopia. It's a disaster everywhere it's been tried, yet you can sell it really well if you leave that stuff out. So if you have people who have grown up with no real United States and liberty versus the Soviet Union, socialism, communism, fascism, no firsthand understanding of that, they missed it, they were born after it, you can convince them that, hey, there's some pretty good ideas out there. We can do this. It's pretty simple, and it's really only selfishness and greed that is stopping us from doing it, from achieving utopia. The same thing is going to come true for these people who were born on September 11th and after, as they become old enough to vote. They won't understand it. They can watch the videos, but it's not going to be in high def. They can hear the stories, but secondhand accounts are not really the same. They don't have the impact. So they are going to fall prey to the United States as a xenophobic country. It's a racist country. What happened on September 11th was really a response to an aggressive, almost colonial approach by the United States to the Middle East, and that sort of left-wing garbage that is sort of exemplified in the New York Times. No, it wasn't the Muslim radical terrorists that did it. It was the airplanes who did it. Now, you can argue all day that, well, everybody knows that airplanes didn't fly themselves, and you're being a little bit overdramatic here. But I'm not. No one brick builds a wall. Every little brick adds to the wall, and this is yet another brick. And it's brick after brick after brick, and these kids have been inundated with bricks, and inundated with bricks by people who have bricks in their heads throughout their entire education. And it will continue throughout the entirety of their education and will be reinforced by a media like the New York Times, subtly changing. You don't just turn a ship on a dime. You have to turn it slowly, slowly, especially if you don't want the people on board to notice that you're turning. You don't make any quick, sudden moves. You do it gradually, a little bit at a time. And that's what makes this so important. Also, the fact more than 2,000 people died. 23, I think, shy of 3,000 people died. You could say almost 3,000 people died. You could even just round up. Nobody would call you out on it and say 3,000 people died. Because there's a possibility that there were a couple of dozen people in the World Trade Center who did die. The people were pulverized when the buildings collapsed, and there are a lot of people, especially in a place like New York, where they don't have any family. Nobody knew they were missing, and nobody had a clue. So more than 2,000 people? Can't the New York Times get that basic fact right? If they think these autonomous planes didn't, shouldn't they at least get the number right or more right? Theoretically, using the logic here, you could say more than one person died on September 11th, 2001. Because it's true, more than one person died. You could also say less than a million people died on that day. But we have the ability to be more precise in our language. The New York Times insists on precision in language from conservatives constantly, certainly the Trump administration, absolutely. Why would they not insist on it from themselves? Well, because they hold themselves to different standards. The New York Times later on did, they deleted the tweet. They tweeted out, we've deleted an earlier tweet to this story and have edited for clarity. The story has also been updated, and ultimately they changed it to read, 18 years have passed since terrorists commandeered airplanes to take aim at the World Trade Center, bringing them down. Now, was it that hard? Of course it's not that hard. But when you have the mentality that you had it coming, that guns are the reason that people get shot, not the people holding them, that guns somehow have this magic power over people. It's not that big of a stretch to then project that onto airplanes, onto everything else. No, there was a very specific foe that took aim at the United States that killed 3,000 plus Americans when you consider the other locations on September 11th. The left just doesn't want you to know that, because the left would rather you think that it is the biggest threat to your safety and your life is evil whitey. Evil mean white nationalist terrorists, white people who love this country, which is insane, which is stupid, which is why they push it and why so many people sadly believe it. Speaking of sad people believing ridiculous things, the Democrats are debating tonight. Yes, this is the third round as the field slowly begins to whittle down. There are only 10 Democrats going to be on stage tonight and only one night of debates. That means a whole bunch of them didn't make it because they raised the criteria. They really don't want to hear from some of those fringe candidates, and who can blame them? But the problem is all the way up and down the choices is crazy. Normally, you start raising the criteria for debates because you want to keep the crazies out of it. Let's just keep Dennis Kucinich on the sidelines. Let's make it a little harder to get in. Well, Dennis Kucinich is up and down the ballot. Up and down the roster of people running for president from the Democratic Party. But there are a couple of new polls out that show that Joe Biden is still ahead, still up in front. But there is one that has him tied with Elizabeth Warren. Now, remember last week we had the one poll that showed Elizabeth Warren out in front, and everybody, myself included, said, you know what, we need to see this repeated someplace before. Like, there's no doubt Joe Biden's a horrible candidate, and he's certainly not the choice of many of the Democratic primary voters. But one poll, you can't really tell anything from. Especially when most people aren't paying attention. So that poll showed that it wasn't exactly true. It wasn't accurate. It wasn't repeated anyplace else. Nobody else found that. Well, there's another one. This one from The Economist and YouGov. I don't know what the hell YouGov is. But they have Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden tied both at 26%, with Bernie a full 10 points behind at 16%, and then everybody else on a sliding scale all the way down. They're the only ones to find that. But it'll be interesting, because all of them do show that Elizabeth Warren is in second place. And as we go into this debate, the narrative being built up is, what's going to happen between Joe and Elizabeth? Is Joe going to attack her? Is she going to attack Joe? Or is she going to offer him the peace pipe? What's going to go on? What's going to happen? I don't think that's the real story here. They both have their vulnerabilities and certainly could go after each other. I think the real story here, though, is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders feels robbed from 2016, mostly because he was robbed in 2016. The Democratic establishment made sure that he did not stand a chance. The debates were scheduled opposite things that nobody would make them less desirable to watch. They had very few debates. They did everything they could as a power, as exposed in by WikiLeaks, to make sure that Bernie was disadvantaged. And still, he came pretty damn close to winning the nomination. Neither one of them actually won the nomination outright. It was the superdelegates ultimately that decided it for Hillary. It's just that Hillary had more delegates than Bernie Sanders, and he wasn't going to get the superdelegates. So he is got that anger that comes with being robbed of something you felt like you'd won, which is a little bit ironic coming from a socialist, but hey, what are you going to do? So I expect him to be the one to watch out there. Because for a long time before Joe Biden got in the race, Bernie was the favorite. Now, he was never the runaway favorite. Everybody knew that Joe Biden was going to get in the race and he had won in all the polls. But of the announced candidates, he was the front runner. He was out there. He was the progressive standard bearer. Now it's Elizabeth Warren, at least for now. We're still very few or many months away from anybody actually voting. And I think Bernie Sanders has to start worrying that he is fading into also-ran status, which is, if you consider it just a few years ago, it's a pretty major drop. Bernie's biggest problem, though, isn't that Bernie has changed. It's not that his message is different. You wouldn't be able, you'd be hard-pressed to tell the difference between Bernie Sanders in 2016 and Bernie Sanders in 2019. There really is, he's a committed socialist, and he has remained a committed socialist. What the difference is the rest of the field is now right there with him. So you don't need to go to crazy Bernie. Bernie went from the alternative to Hillary Clinton to the old white guy, or one of the two old white guys in the field. And in just three short years, the progressive movement, of which Bernie is a big leader, managed to denigrate old white guys to the point that now Bernie is suffering from it. And when you say, well, Bernie wants socialized medicine, Bernie wants free college, Bernie wants to take care of student debt, Bernie wants this, Bernie wants that, and then you look at the rest of the field, well, I can get that for the same thing from Elizabeth Warren, but I can also feel really, really proud of myself and spend a whole lot of time congratulating myself about how progressive I am if I vote for a woman. So I'll vote for Elizabeth Warren. Or I could get the same things from Kamala Harris. And not only do I get to congratulate myself because I voted for a woman, I voted for a woman of color. See, they're all basically running on the same thing. Bernie is just one of a field of people who are radical leftists, whereas in 2016 it was Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was the nut job lefty, and Hillary Clinton was thought of as the establishment nut job lefty. But, you know, when you can sit there and you can say, well, I could vote for Bernie, but I could get the same thing if I voted for Pete Buttigieg, who is significantly younger and gay. Why, that'll show the whole world that I'm super duper progressive. So Bernie has to come up with some way, sooner or later, and it might not be tonight, but sooner or later, he's going to have to come to this fork on the road, in the road, and decide whether or not he wants to bow out gracefully, or whether or not he is willing to really fight for this in a way that is stands a chance of winning. I don't know that it'll be tonight, but Bernie, watching Bernie over the next few months and few debates, I think is going to be much more entertaining than the current flavor of the moment, Elizabeth Warren. I will say this about the field. If you look down the roster, and the other ones are fading, the Klobuchar's fading, Beto O'Rourke is nearly done in that YouGov Economist poll. He polls 1%. Andrew Yang polls twice as much. And Pete Buttigieg is all the way down to 6% in the YouGov poll. The Real Clear Politics average of polls has Mayor Pete at 4.6%. He's, barring something major, he's pretty well done too. So it really, at least as of this point, is a fight between Biden, Warren, and Sanders. Joe Biden is thought of as the safe choice by the Democratic establishment. He's also compared to this field, although he's trying, which I think is a huge strategic screw up on his part, but then his whole campaign has been a strategic screw up and gaffe after gaffe. He is trying to appeal to the same group of people that the Warrens, the Sanders, the Buttigieges, the Harrises are trying to appeal to. Joe Biden is trying to be a radical lefty. He's not quite there. He's not, let's get rid of all private health insurance and have the government take over it all. He's not calling for that yet. But if he thinks he can get an advantage of it, he will, because I don't think Joe Biden actually believes in much of anything except that he really wants to be president, and he also believes that he deserves to be president. But that means that the 20 to 20 onwards up to 30% that Joe Biden is getting in these polls, depending on which poll, and it's always between like 22 and 30%. Those are the moderate people. Those are the people who are either moderate or believe that Joe Biden is the most electable, which is another thing that Joe Biden has going for him, is the belief that he's most electable. That means that upwards of 70% of Democratic primary voters don't care about those things. They'd rather go down swinging on their socialist dream than go for somebody they're being told by people they clearly don't trust that Joe Biden is the most electable. What that means is, as the Amy Klobuchars and the Tulsi Gabbards and the Cory Bookers and eventually the Beto O'Rourkes, as they begin to drop out of the race, the possibility of Joe Biden getting that support is pretty slim. Because if you are an Amy Klobuchar supporter or a Joaquin Castro supporter, for example, Joaquin Castro on the Real Clear Politics average of polls is at 0.9%. It's not earth-shattering. But if you're sticking with Joaquin Castro, if he's your guy, the odds are that he's your guy because of identity politics. He really brings nothing unique to the table. He brings no experience to the table, nothing worth noting, nothing to be particularly proud of. He was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under Barack Obama, and he was the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, which is mostly a figurehead job. So I suspect that the 0.9% who are down there with Joaquin Castro are the he looks like me, I'm going to vote for him crowd. That's big in Democratic Party politics. When he drops out, because he'll drop out because he's not getting any fundraising and he's just fading. Nobody cares. Where does his support go? Well, if it's based on identity politics, it's going to be hard-pressed for people who believe in a radical liberal agenda, who believe that somebody who looks like them is the only person who can support or can represent them. It's not going to go to the old white guy. It's not going to go to Joe Biden. It's probably not going to go to Bernie Sanders. It most likely it would end up with Elizabeth Warren, because at least on the hierarchy of intersectionality, of victimhood culture that the left has fully embraced, she's a woman. So that would be my guess. In any event, as the also-rans do begin to drop out, it's more likely than not that their voters will go and support either Warren or Sanders more so than it is for Joe Biden. Because everybody knows Joe Biden. There's no ambiguity about who Joe Biden is. You're not going to learn anything new about Joe Biden. Joe Biden is not going to give you a speech that suddenly opens your eyes and says, holy Frank Tanana, Joe Biden, I never really knew him, and now he's my guy. He's the one person in the field they know. And he can only pull a maximum of 33% in one poll. So they're not going to go flocking to him if they aren't naturally drawn to him. That means that this could be a long, drawn-out process. I can see Sanders and Warren are going to be in this for a while, even if Bernie fades. Bernie, I think, sticks into this to the end, just because communists stick into things to the bitter end. I can see Kamala Harris sticking around. I can see Mayor Pete sticking around, even if they still hover between 5 and 10% in the polls. They've got nothing better to do. They're about raising their profile and setting themselves up for future gigs, future runs. So if you have a situation where you go into these primaries, and remember, the Democrats really revamped as part of appeasing Bernie and trying to get Bernie not to really screw up Hillary's chances. It's funny to say that. In 2016, the Democratic National Committee changed a lot of their rules. They eliminated the superdelegates for the first round of balloting. I believe they're giving out proportional delegates based on the order of finish in a lot of states. So you could end up in a situation where three or four candidates make it through, if they can afford to, if they can raise the money, make it through the entire nominating process, and nobody gets a clear majority. Because if, you know, 7 of them, 10 of them, I mean, really 24 of them, right, or 20, I guess they're down to 21 or something like that. There'll be 15 to 18 of them that are still in the race by the time of Iowa. Most of them will be also rans, but they'll pull enough that maybe a couple of them will get delegates. And then there'll be a few of them, maybe a couple less in New Hampshire. The longer a large field stays in this and they divvy up their delegates in a screwed up way rather than winner takes all, because winning is bad to the Democratic Party, the more likely it is that they go limping into their convention next year in, I think it's in Milwaukee. I was like, where was that? Yes, it's Milwaukee. That they go limping into their convention next year with nobody having a majority. There's always a possibility that they could cut some kind of deal. The couple of them could get together. You be the vice president. You'll give me your delegates and we'll get over the edge, blah, blah, blah. But if they don't do that, they could have another possibility where they tried to limit the superdelegate impact, because the superdelegates are party elders, big donors, special people, favored class. The people who want everybody to be treated equally always end up with creating a favored class. The superdelegates get to vote in the second round of balloting if there is nobody with a majority in the first round of balloting at the Democratic convention. So they could end up again in a situation that they desperately tried to avoid by upending this whole system a couple years ago, trying to appease Bernie Sanders. And it could again screw Bernie Sanders. I just love it. I love it. It's going to be fun to watch. But as we watch this debate tonight, and if you don't worry, I'll have whatever highlights there are on the show on Friday. So don't ruin your Thursday. I'll ruin mine so you don't have to ruin yours. Watching this, yes, there is some possible intrigue of will Biden and Warren mix it up? Will they get into it? But really, it's important to watch Bernie Sanders. He's got to do something to differentiate himself from the pack, because they've co-opted him. In a way, he's a victim of his own success. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. On a similar note, as far as crazy leftists go, you remember the push, or that wasn't really a push, the mentions of, well, you know, we should lower the voting age to 16. The Nancy Pelosi said she's always been in favor of lowering the voting age to 16 because children are our future. And the more they get engaged civically, the higher the chance they'll be engaged civically the rest of their lives, which is crap. They just know that they can easily manipulate these people. The problem is that once, you know, you're 18, you start working, you start getting out into the real world, you leave the education bubble, and you begin to see that so much of the social conditioning that you were fed, force-fed, was crap. You get your first couple of paychecks, and you say, wait a second, where did all this money go? And then people start to question things, and that is the enemy of liberalism. Well, this from Vox, Vox, V-O-X, it is a well-funded left-wing propaganda outfit, and the left loves it. They're all over. MSNBC uses this to program their network in large ways. They have a piece up, The Case for Changing the Voting Age to Zero. It's kind of fun. They want, the second they come out, they should be able to vote. Up until that point, you should be able to kill them. Like right before, as they're in the middle of giving birth, if you want to wipe them out, go ahead. But after that, they should be registered to vote. They say, in just over a year, American citizens will have a chance to cast their ballot for the next president, except for the 75 million Americans barred by state and local laws from registering to vote, that is. Are there really that many American citizens legally barred from voting? The answer is yes. Our kids. See, you only want to do something like this when you're not able to win a majority of the already existing voting pool. Same reason they want open borders and they want amnesty for everybody and they want a path to citizenship. It's not out of the kindness of their hearts. Not at all. It is about replacing current voters with voters they can count on. Because so many people who are watching these debates and have watched Democrats and remember the Obama economy and things, they go, I'm not going to vote for that. That's crazy. They were failures. They were awful. And you have a situation where they go, all right, well, rather than try and convince these voters, because they're on to us, the jig is up, let's just get new voters. So let's lower the voting age to zero. Around the world, almost every country bars people under 18 from voting. The reasons vary. They won't be informed enough. They don't pay taxes yet. They can't serve in the military yet. They tend to liberal, they tend to rebellious, but the rules persist, even in the face of a generation of passionate, smart, informed teenage activists, and even as it becomes obvious that our current political system is failing our children. Vox, I told you, was a radical left-wing activist outlet that is treated as news because it's down-the-line liberal. Don't you love that? Because they're teenage activists, we must therefore allow them to vote. Obviously, they agree with me and my politics. Therefore, they should be allowed to vote. It shows that they're mature, that they agree with me. Of course, when anybody at Vox encounters anybody with whom they do disagree, which doesn't happen very often, they don't exactly venture outside their little circle of protection, they don't know how to handle it. They will not. You find a young conservative activist, you find a 15-year-old pro-life activist, and I guarantee you Vox will not respect their opinions. You don't understand. You're only 15 years old. You don't understand what it's like in the real world. But a 15-year-old pro-abortion activist, why, they'll put him on the cover of a magazine. A 15-year-old girl with Asperger's syndrome, well, they'll cheer her sailing across the Atlantic to give a speech because she loses sleep at night because she believes that in 11 years the world is going to come to an end. A normal person looks at that and says, somebody needs to talk to that girl because she's unstable. She's being terrified. She's being manipulated by the adults around her. And she is being manipulated. Greta Thunberg is being manipulated. I talked about it last week. She's being manipulated around by the people around her. There is a lot of money in the Greta Thunberg industry. I don't know how much of it is ending up in her pocket, but it's lining lots of pockets, fundraising off of it, given to various causes in the name of it. It's nobody really cares about her. And Vox doesn't really care what children think. They care that they can't get enough Democratic votes to sweep Republicans out of power so that they can impose their will on the American people. In the last year, there have been encouraging signs that we might rethink this. Democratic candidate Andrew Yang has argued for a voting age of 16. A bill proposed a voting age of 16 died in the House in March, with a majority of Democratic representatives supporting it. Well, let's do them one better. The United States should consider eradicating the voting age entirely and letting every American citizen who can successfully fill out a ballot be counted in our local, state, and national elections. And yes, that goes for felons, too. If one of these candidates are asked about, I guess a couple of them might say, no, you shouldn't. My 2-year-old daughter should not be filling. Can you imagine reading my daughter's ballot? You send her in there. We thought you had a problem in 2000 with hanging chads and people who were incapable of punching just one hole or punching successfully through a pre-perforated hole. You imagine getting 4-year-olds in there? All right, now take your crayon and fill out the circle for the candidate that you support. Where's Mickey Mouse? Which one is PJ Masks? These people are unserious, yet they have the House of Representatives. They have a decent chance of winning the White House and a decent chance of taking back the Senate. They could at any time win. You never know what's going to happen in the next year and a half. If this is what they're advocating now, imagine what they're keeping to themselves. You know, because politicians always tell you what they want you to hear. Political journalists tell you what they think you will, what they think is best for you to hear to advance their agenda. But in private, as with everybody, they say things a little bit differently. Maybe somebody who's very, very proper and polite and would never think of cursing in their lives, behind closed doors, you get a couple of beers in them, and then they start swearing like it's like they're Andrew Dice Clay or something, you know, like they just go crazy. They change dramatically. They go more extreme when they think they're in a safe space. If this is the kind of crap that these people are willing to talk about in public, imagine what they would do if they actually got power. Imagine all the stuff they want to do that their inner monologue that says to everybody, don't do what, don't say that. Don't go that crazy. Don't let them get on to you. What are they holding back if this is the stuff they're putting out there in public? That should scare the hell out of everybody. Forget Greta Thunberg being woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning or AOC being woken up at 3:30 in the morning with horrors of the coasts flooding and the oceans rising and, oh, climate change. Fear what's going to happen to you as an individual and the people you care about if people who think it's normal to say this stuff out loud actually get the ability to start acting on the things they really want to do, but are afraid to tell anybody. Speaking of which, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez there was a hearing yesterday up on Capitol Hill. The Trump administration is considering deporting illegal aliens. Shocking, right? I know. I don't know who this surprises anymore, and I'm not sure why this surprises anybody, because the illegal part should be enough to be a tip-off that something must be done because they're breaking the law. They have no right to be in this country, and there's always been this exemption, apparently, or at least for a while has been this exemption, for people getting medical treatment. I don't understand why, and this is going to make me sound really super heartless, but only because I am really super heartless. There are a lot of, not millions or anything, but there are a lot of illegal aliens in this country who are getting medical treatment. They have no ability to pay for it. They came here either illegally and worked and got sick and they're getting medical treatment, or they came here because they're sick and they wanted to get free medical treatment. Whatever the case, it doesn't really matter. They should be deported. We cannot be the world's emergency room. We cannot be the world's healthcare provider. But AOC seems to think we should be. In this hearing, she's talking to a left-wing activist. Her name is irrelevant. I love her so-called questions during this thing. It's like, do you agree with me that we suck? Do you agree with me that the Trump administration is awful and trying to kill people? I don't think she understands. Well, no, I take that back. I know she doesn't understand what the immigration policy of this country used to be. And I don't think leftists, certainly college students don't, it's not taught. But the idea, the people who say that the Statue of Liberty is, that it says, send us your tired, your poor, and your weak, and therefore we should let everybody into the country because the Statue of Liberty has a poem that says, these sorts of people, they have no concept of what was actually going on from an immigration perspective at the time of Ellis Island. Right there behind the Statue of Liberty. They think it was just a turnstile way station. As you come off the boats from wherever you come from, just make sure that we get an accurate count. Come on through, come on in. That is not what Ellis Island was. Ellis Island is as a campus. If you ever go to Ellis Island, there's lots of buildings, and a lot of buildings are gone, but you see models of what it used to be look like. It used to be a bunch of kind of like dormitories. Now, why would you need dormitories if it were just a head-counting way station that people come through and walk through a turnstile and say, come on in, just go on, welcome, welcome, please, please. Well, it's because the people who were coming at the golden age of immigration, as they say, they weren't just welcomed with open arms because at the foot of Lady Liberty there's an Emma Lazarus poem. They were questioned. They were inspected. They were examined by medical professionals. If you didn't have the ability to take care of yourself or have somebody here in this country willing to make sure that if you couldn't take care of yourself, they were going to take care of yourself, take care of you, so that you would not become a burden on the public, you were turned around. It didn't matter how long the boat journey was to get here or how seasick you got along the way. You had to prove that you were bringing something to the table. You weren't just allowed to step off a boat and say, I'm here. I just want to be here. That's all. I just want to be here. The Ellis Island way station was, okay, that's really neat. There's a lot of people who want to be here, but you're not going to be one of them. You've got to go back. They also did medical examinations on people. If you were coughing, if you were wheezing, if you looked wrong, if you had a fever, you were held there. They wanted to make sure that you weren't bringing in disease. You know, hello, anybody notice the recurrence of diseases that have long since been eradicated from these countries, this country? I mean, for God's sakes, leprosy is making a comeback out in Los Angeles. Are we back in biblical times? It's because of liberal policies and unfettered education or immigration. So the idea that, well, we're only imposing these new things on it because we're racist is wrong. If you, they would send you back if you didn't have all your teeth. They would send you back if they thought you had something. Because let's face it, in the teens and 20s, they didn't exactly have the cutting-edge medical technology where they could take a little bit of blood, look at it under a microscope, run a couple of tests on you, and find out if you're sick or not. They did not want people coming into this country who didn't bring something to the table and were going to be a drag on society, who brought in disease, who brought in sickness, or weren't going to be able to contribute. And that was a pretty good and effective model. We're not allowed to have that model anymore. To listen to AOC in this clip, it is downright inhumane that we would dare deport anybody who is sick and getting treatment in this country when, in fact, they're never going to pay for it. Well, guess who's going to end up paying for it? Because they're not. You and me are. We're going to. Our tax money, well, actually, our tax money, all the tax money you're going to pay in your lifetime is already spent. With $22.5 trillion in debt, it doesn't matter how much money you make. Everything you pay in taxes and really everything you've earned has already been spent by the government. It's your kids and your grandkids who are going to get screwed over big time. But listen to this exchange and listen to what she doesn't come right out and say it. She walks right up to the line. Listen to what she thinks of the United States of America and what you as a taxpayer should be responsible for.
Folks and people like Mr. Sanchez and Ms. Bueso are not collateral damage to this administration's policy. They are the target, correct?
Correct.
Is targeting and changing policy to specifically target people with life-threatening diseases for deportation, essentially killing them through deportation, would you characterize that as cruel?
I would.
This is a cruel policy change, and this fits a pattern that we have been seeing over and over again before this committee of a culture and a policies specifically almost animated by cruelty. We hear over and over again, and we've heard it today from folks across this committee, that they're under-resourced, that we have to continue dumping billions of dollars into enforcement, into putting children in cages, into a system that is quite literally killing people. But meanwhile, we are adding to the resource strains by forcing people to go through the ordeal, forcing this country through the ordeal of needlessly deporting people like Ms. Bueso and Mr. Sanchez. Of course you're under-resourced for your goals, because your goals is to deport people that have no reason, on humanitarian grounds or otherwise, to be deported.
Yes, they are in this country illegally. They are sick. Even if they were in this country legally, if they were coming in, trying to come in legally, and they are sick, they should not be allowed in this country. Not that they're going to, not that it's something, you know, communicable, some airborne disease, but if somebody is riddled with cancer or somebody is diabetic and they want to immigrate to the United States, they absolutely 100% should be said, told, no, you can't come in. You will be a burden on society. I'm sorry, you are sick. You cannot contribute. And you've got to set standards. We have to ask the question, what do we get out of this? It's not selfish. It's not mean. It is, what do we get? It's smart. You're going to come here and suddenly we're going to say, well, all right, send us everybody who's sick. We'll take care of them. Well, we can't afford to do that. And for her to say, well, if we, basically what she's saying is, if we just stopped enforcing, if we took all the money we're using to enforce our border, to make sure our border is secure, to make sure that truckloads of heroin aren't coming over and fentanyl aren't coming over the border, and, you know, people are who are breaking the law and breaking into the country are apprehended. If we just take all that money, fire all those people, we should then be able to pay for the medical bills without any problems whatsoever. If we get rid of all deportations and all ICE officials and all customs and immigration people everywhere in the country, we should just dedicate that money to taking care of this sweet, sweet, nourishing, illegal and legal aliens. Well, there wouldn't be any illegal aliens. Anybody who wanders across the border. That's insane. I'm sorry that anybody is sick. But we cannot be the world's emergency room. Do you have any idea how many people around the world would just show up here in the United States if the Democrats, who've all advocated that their universal health care plans would provide free of charge health care to illegal aliens, you have any idea how much that would cost? You have any idea the shitstorm that would open? Everybody sick in the world would come to the United States. You know who would get screwed? Americans who are sick, who need medical attention. The lines would be so long. You imagine? There would be, of course, you wouldn't be allowed to take cuts. There would be no Americans priority. Oh, a priority for Americans? No, 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 I'm sorry. Everybody must be treated. We're citizens of the world, don't you know? And by the way, while you're waiting there and dying slowly or in severe pain, we need to raise your taxes because we just got a jumbo 777 from Zimbabwe full of people with lesions. And so we got to take care of them, and that ain't cheap. So open up your wallets while you slowly die. It is insane. What she's advocating there. You can feel bad for the individuals in those situations, but that should never, ever, if you're a rational adult who has a handle on their emotions and is not ruled by them, you should never, ever be governed by it. You should not be making those decisions. You can say, oh, Derek, you're just heartless. How can you do that? Is so mean. What about the children? What about these sick people? What are you going to do? Doom and gloom them? No, I'm not dooming them to anything. They are subject to the laws. Sick Americans are still subject to the laws in this country. Illegal aliens should not be any different. You know, well, we're going to defer on this one for you, illegal alien. We're going to pick up your health care. It'll take, what, 14 months of intense treatment and about $350,000 we'll never see again. And then at that point, once we patch you back up, we'll send you back to your home country. No. Your home country has some responsibilities. And I get that there are a lot of crappy countries out there. Fix your country. Use these as opportunities to change your countries, to fight to change your countries. You don't get to come here just because your country sucks. You don't get to just walk into somebody else's house and set up shop because, well, your house is run down. That's not the way it works. It's a recipe for disaster. Along those lines on immigration, yesterday the Trump administration got a victory from the Supreme Court, Associated Press, the Supreme Court is allowing nationwide enforcement of a new Trump administration rule that prevents most Central American migrants from seeking asylum in the United States. The justice's order late Wednesday temporarily undoes a lower court order that blocked the new asylum policy in some states along the southern border. The policy is meant to deny asylum to anyone who passes through another country on the way to the U.S. without seeking protection there, which is international law. You do not get to travel through a whole bunch of countries that where you could claim asylum, because where you really want to be is on the other end of them. Everybody wants to come to the United States, and they use asylum, by the way, as garbage, as cover. It's a scam. But they walk through Mexico, they'll walk through other countries and say, well, now I need to get, I'm seeking asylum in the United States. Well, why don't you seek asylum in Mexico? If you're fleeing for your life from Guatemala, if you're scared for your life in El Salvador, why didn't anybody ever go south, by the way? Because you can get out of those countries just as easily going south as you can going north. But once you get to Mexico, whatever local drug lord was trying to kill you in your backwoods village in Honduras isn't going to chase you up to Mexico. Unless you're a player in the drug world yourself and it's revenge. So you're safe. That's what asylum is supposed to be. You're supposed to seek it the first place you get to where whatever it was you're fleeing is done. The Trump administration then said, okay, we're going to enforce this now. So all of these asylum claims at the southern border are crap. All the training that the Democratic operatives did, and we'll get into more of this tomorrow. We'll get into immigration a lot with Michelle Malkin on the show because that's what her new book is about. But we're going to just say, no, you don't get to come to the United States. All the training that these leftist groups have instilled as soon as you get across the border, as soon as you're arrested, say that you're seeking asylum, that you have credible fear for your life back in your hometown, and then you get in. That was the key. This ruling and this push by the Trump administration undoes that. It's a big deal. Now, this case, it's temporary at this point. This case is still working its way up the courts. But as is often the case, some liberal judge somewhere says, we're just going to stop this for now. Finally, a victory for the sake of sanity. But what the decision was 7-2, by the way, 7-2. The two justices that voted against this were Darth Vader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor. And Sonia Sotomayor is getting, they're both getting a whole bunch of press. And in her dissent, Sotomayor, this is where the left is really going, getting excited. They're getting sexually aroused at what Sotomayor wrote in her dissent, which is irrelevant. It's a freaking dissent. It means she lost, and it was 7-2. So it wasn't just those mean old conservatives. Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, ultimately, it appears the government has treated this exceptional mechanism as the new normal. Historically, the government has made this kind of request rarely. Now it does it reflexively. Who cares? She also said that this, quote, sidesteps the ordinary judicial process to allow government to implement a rule that bypasses the ordinary rulemaking process. Once again, the executive branch has issued a rule that seeks to upend longstanding practices regarding refugees who seek shelter from persecution. Justice Sotomayor is on the Supreme Court for the rest of her life, unfortunately. But the idea of upending long-standing practices. Now, there's always this idea of precedent, legal precedent. But long-standing practices are not legal precedent. They're just long-standing practices. What matters is what the law says. And the Constitution and the law are pretty unambiguous that a great amount of authority in enforcing immigration policy lies within the executive branch. But I'm sorry that Darth Vader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor don't feel comfortable. They feel that this is upsetting long-standing practice. If you spent the rest of your life in law school, you would not hear about the doctrine of long-standing practices. But when you're a liberal on the Supreme Court and you're 10 feet tall and bulletproof and you know that what's going to happen, nothing, you can't be fired, you got that job for as long as you want it, you can look at the Constitution and say, that's neat. What a quaint little old document. But I've decided that the statute is irrelevant based on long-standing practices. Forget the law. Thankfully, she was in the distinct minority, Sonia Sotomayor. She lost. And when a liberal loses, that means Americans win. Anyway, we are out of time. Again, time goes flying by. There's so much stuff I wanted to get to. Just ran out of time. My motor mouth. Anyway, thanks for listening. You can email me to enter to win the Sean Parnell book till 10 p.m. Eastern time tonight, Thursday, the 12th of September. Otherwise, it will be too late. Derek at DailyCaller.com. Tomorrow on the program, debate recap and Michelle Malkin. You won't want to miss either of them. See you then. The Daily Daily Caller podcast is produced by Derek Hunter. Director, Derek Hunter. It's executive produced by Derek Hunter. Senior producer is Derek Hunter. Supervising producer is Derek Hunter. Technical producer is Derek Hunter. It was edited by Derek Hunter. The audio mixing was done by Derek Hunter. Hair and makeup provided by Derek Hunter's Pillow and Soap. Production assistance provided by The Cats. This joke was submitted by listener Christopher Flatten. And this joke is funny because it's true.